If you plant a field down to yellow blossom alfalfa, falcata alfalfa, that it's going to be there for many, many years. So there's no need to reseed after so many years because it, you know, it persists for so long.
Knowledge for Resilience, a cross-commodity podcast brought to you jointly by the Peace River Forage Association, the Peace Region Forage Seed Association, and the BC Grain Producers Association. Welcome to episode 24. I'm your host, Nadia Mori. Today, I'm talking with Peter Lundgaard. Peter is an organic forage and livestock producer near Grimshaw, Alberta. He also has a long-standing expertise in forage seed production. Peter was specifically drawn to the long-lasting yellow blossom alfalfa as he came across some early research information and learned about stands persisting well beyond 30 years in very harsh northern climate conditions. Stand by for great stories of the history of yellow blossom alfalfa, its many benefits for forage and livestock producers, and why it is so well adapted to our northern climate. Without further ado, let's get seeding. Today I get to talk to Peter Lundgaard. Welcome to the podcast, Peter.
Thank you.
If you maybe could start us off and just give us a little bit of an introduction of yourself, where you're located, and how you got into the cool world of forage seed production.
I was born and raised in northwestern Alberta in the Peace River region, and Fairview and Hinds Creek was where I grew up. I was raised on a mixed farm. We grew all sorts of grain crops and forage seed crops and brome grass, and we raised cattle and sheep and hogs and chickens and laying hens and whatnot. And so I was always interested in agriculture. I went into Fairview College, and they had an ag program there in the mid-70s, and carried on, and I started farming in the late 1970s. I guess I was always attracted to alfalfa as a crop to grow. It was a crop that was a very long-lived crop. It produced nitrogen. It was a leguminous plant producing nitrogen. There was different markets for it in hay production or pasture forage for cattle and or seed production. Anyways, I was very keen and interested in that, and I started studying it late 70s, early 80s, and I started planting fields of alfalfa. I guess it was maybe in the 80s, mid-80s, 1980s, I learned of this yellow blossom alfalfa. So I started really studying the yellow blossom alfalfa and started learning some of the characteristics and traits of it. And so I went on following that, the yellow blossom alfalfa, along with the other purple flowered alfalfas. But so I started searching for seed, and I got some seed, and I started talking to people at the research stations at Beaver Lodge and Fort Vermilion. And over the years, I studied the history of it. And so the difference between yellow blossom alfalfa and purple blossom alfalfa is that the yellow blossom alfalfa, it's a subspecies of the purple flowered alfalfa, which the Latin is Medicago sativa. And for the yellow blossom is a subspecies, it's a Medicago falcata. And a Medicago falcata comes from the northern part of Europe and Asia. And Medicago sativa comes from the southern parts of Europe and Asia, I imagine. The thing about the yellow blossom alfalfa, it's predominantly been grazed by the nomadic herdsmen of the northern areas of Europe and Asia. So that was intriguing. And so I was always also interested in livestock and cattle in particular. So when I realized that the yellow blossom alfalfa was extremely long-lived and it was low in this fraction one protein, and the fraction one protein, I went on to learn that that was one of the major factors in bloat in livestock and cattle. So then that really intrigued me. I guess another thing was I noticed it was brought out in the late 1970s, a variety, and some of the Forage Association members in 1978, I believe it was, they started growing some of it. And some years later, I noticed it along the side of the road. And it was the only alfalfa that survived the winters. And the road grader had been grading it off the snow all winter long, and it still persisted. Where other alfalfas, if you plowed snow in the wintertime out in the field, they would just, the purple flowered ones would die. So I was really excited then to see its persistence. And of course, the other aspect of it for grazing and the no bloat aspect of it. So I did a lot of research on it. I found the, in 1935, it came to Canada from Russia. A plant breeder brought some back with her, and it was in Ottawa. And then later it went to the northernmost research station, and that was in Alberta, Fort Vermilion. And then from Fort Vermilion, some of the seed stocks went to Beaver Lodge, and eventually, then some went up to a research station in the Yukon, mile 1019, the Haines Junction research station. So that's some of the history of it. Then I found other history of it. There was a fellow that brought alfalfa from, or different seeds from all parts of the, you know, he was a seed gatherer, and he was down in, I think, South Dakota. And he gathered over 400 species of seeds from Europe and Asia in particular. And one of the ones that he was really intrigued by was this yellow blossom alfalfa. And he brought some of that over like 1905 to 1910 era. And they started propagating it there. And then he started distributing it to farmers and ranchers. And some of that is still persists to this day that they established in that area. So that was really exciting when I found that out. And then also in my research, I find that the plots that they had up in the Yukon, they closed that research station down in late 60s, early 70s. I'm not sure of the year, but I got a report from the research station in 1959. And they said that that was the only legume that persisted, survived a prior winter. So then that was very exciting. And of course, that was likely the excitement of it that caused the plant breeders to start looking at it more seriously and started breeding it. And then they eventually brought a variety out in 1974 at Beaver Lodge Research Station. So that was kind of some of the history of how I got to know about it and did the research on it and how it got to Canada, North America and into Canada and how it ended up in Beaver Lodge and how it ended up near our farm, you know, in the late 1970s, early 80s from some of the demonstration plots they had going. So that's how I knew about it.
And the variety that was released in Beaver Lodge, was that Anik at the time or was that a different one?
Yeah, it was Anik. That's about the only variety that was released was Anik, and it was in 1974. Dr. Peter Pankey was the plant breeder. There was a few producers in the 70s, late 70s, but the markets really never took off with it because the seed yield was so low. And so when I started looking into seed stocks, it wasn't very plentiful. And I also got in talking with some plant breeders up in Fort Vermilion, and they still had some seed stocks. So I started propagating some of those seed stocks and started propagating. And so we were propagating also some of the seed stocks that we were able to locate from the, that was established in the late 1970s. So then we started doing some selections and got some extremely good results out of that. But in the 1980s and stuff, it was slow to catch on. And the seed producers, they weren't too excited about producing seed because the yield was so low. But the reason the yield is low, the seed size is about less than half the size of the Medicago sativa. So when I started propagating it and marketing it, I just told the farmers and ranchers that were establishing it to adjust the seeding rates accordingly to the seed size. And so basically then average seeding rate would be like 12 pounds of purple flower. Well, we'd seed about 6 pounds of Medicago falcata, yellow blossom, and we'd still have this actually more seed counts. And then we just started pricing it accordingly, and we started marketing it back in the 80s and 90s, and then it became more common. And so the great aspects of it, you know, one, it's extremely winter hardy, lasts for many, many years. And there's the low fraction one protein for the non-bloat of it for cattle and sheep. And the other aspect of it is it's a very fine stem plant, much finer than the other alfalfas. And it's a heavy, heavy yielder of hay, forage production. One of the limiting factors is it doesn't regrow, but compensates for that for its yield. In one cut scenario, it yields about as much as 2 cuts of the other one. So that was very attractive of it. So I was very excited about the variety. And so we kept propagating it and marketing it. And some of the longevity stories is like the research station up in Haines Junction there. It was closed down in, I think, the late 60s or at least 1970s. And they established, there's about a 200-acre field up there, and they established it seeded it all down to yellow blossom alfalfa, and it still persists to this day. I know the people that go and hay it every year, so it's just an amazing plant. When we started raising, we've always raised cattle. We started grass finishing them about 35 years ago or 30 some years ago, and the key to it was the yellow blossom alfalfa, and so we used a grass species of metabrome grass. A few years later, we incorporated Sicer milk vetch into the stands. So predominantly is yellow blossom alfalfa and metabrome grass and Sicer milk vetch. And so we've been using that mix for grass finishing beef for many years. And the stand keeps persisting. It always gets better all the time. Like we've been using it in our farm for many, many years.
It sure just sounds like such an amazing plant, and it's fascinating how it never really took off. But I think there's a few reasons, and you touched on some of them, like one of them being the seed size, right? So the seed size is a lot smaller, which you just need to take a different approach in terms of seeding it by cutting the seeding rate. But that's probably also why not a lot of growers want to grow it. Is that correct?
Yeah, yes. Going back into the late 70s and early 80s, the seed producers, like, the yield was less than half, and it was very discouraging for seed yields, and comparing it to the purple flowered varieties, and it didn't catch on for seed production because of that reason. But when you adjust that seeding rate and the cost to seed it, it works out. It's actually a little less expensive than seeding purple flowered varieties because you can cut your seeding poundage per acre back. That's probably one of the reasons. Then the other reason is, I guess, the marketing aspect of it. When you're growing alfalfa seed and marketing seed, you want to, usually it's a short rotation for a lot of farms. Like they grow it for to build their soil and for hay production, and then a lot of them are mixed farms, so then they work it up and reseed or seed it to an annual crop for a few years, and then they might go back into an alfalfa crop. So for that reason, that was, I guess, that's one of the reasons. And nobody really promoted it, and where it really shines, it shines for hay productions, but it really shines for pasture production. And so I guess there maybe wasn't the promotion of it back in the 90s and 80s and 90s or whatever in 2000s. But we started producing it and marketing it in the 90s and went into the 2000s. And I just thought it would catch on a little faster, but I guess it boils down to marketing. And then, of course, a lot of the seed companies, they're in the business of marketing seeds. So if you plant a field down to yellow blossom alfalfa, falcata alfalfa, that it's going to be there for many, many years. So there's no need to reseed after so many years because it persists for so long. So it kind of cuts down in the markets of seed. So seed selling companies like to sell a product that they can resell every 2 or 3 years. And so that's probably another reason. And maybe just the marketing of it. Nobody's really made a big marketing campaign of it.
And maybe another thing too is, like you mentioned, it has a really good yield that first cut, but then it doesn't really regrow. And I think a lot of people are maybe a bit hung up on that mindset that they want to have that fall regrowth. But at the same time, that's also the key factor why the yellow blossom is so persistent, because it's very aggressive in its fall dormancy. Like it just shuts down, and that's why it survives, versus those alfalfa varieties that have a lot of fall regrowth, but then they're maybe not shutting down properly for winter and are a lot more at risk for winter kill. So maybe a bit of mindset shift there would help too.
Like I tell people in the Peace River region and central Alberta and even southern Alberta, like the second cut is usually quite a bit less than the first cut in yield. But if you can get the same production in one cut as versus two cuts of the purple, you're saving a lot of money and time and cost of haying, because it's very expensive to go and hay a crop. So it's very, very beneficial to just go over your field once and get the same amount of production. And the part about the regrowth, we've been grass finishing cattle on it for many years, and we don't really rely on the alfalfa so much for the regrowth as much as rely on the metabrome grass, and probably the Sicer milk vetch comes out there pretty good in the fall too. So those are the regrowth aspects of it. But it does regrow if it gets lots of moisture and you cut it early. It will regrow, but it's very slow. I mean, I've had it blooming in fall when the leaves are starting to turn yellow. It's regrowing and blooming in first to middle of September when the leaves are starting to turn yellow. So, but it takes some adequate rains. That's been our experience.
That's a really good point about harvesting once and just going a bigger harvest then and saving your equipment and fuel and time.
Especially nowadays with the price of fuel, the inputs, it's for like for making hay, fuel and twine has gone up like I think double in the or more in the last few years. It's really quite expensive. But anyways, the cost of making hay has gone up considerably. So that's one good aspect of it. So we have, you know, grazed that regrowth of alfalfa and yellow blossom alfalfa and the metabrome grass and our Sicer milk vetch, you know, into the winter, into a foot or two of snow. We still keep grazing as long as the snow doesn't get a big heavy crust on it or whatnot. It's a great tool, you know, for pasture and really shines for that. So, and it doesn't, like some of these other alfalfa varieties or whatever, if you're regrowing them and grazing them in the fall, they don't stand up well to grazing hoof action and whatnot, whereas Metacauga falcata, it can stand that. So we also noticed that it can withstand a little more standing in water in the springtime than the other alfalfa, the purple-flowered alfalfa. So that's another little bit of a benefit to it. I think that kind of sums up the grazing aspect of it.
If somebody is shopping for yellow blossom alfalfa, have they bred any varieties of the sativa strains that also could have yellow blossoms, but they're not actually falcata?
The creeping rooted alfalfa varieties, like it started with Rambler, was one of the first ones. And they took the Metacauga sativa and they crossed it with the Metacauga falcatas and started selecting for creepingness habit because the yellow blossom one has got a strong lateral root system. That's another aspect that I forgot to mention. The root system on the Metacauga falcata, it's a lateral root system. It goes out in many, many roots and it doesn't have a big long tap root like some of the sativa varieties. So it's a surface moisture feeder. So when it rains, it taps into that moisture near the surface. And of course, where its origins are from that northern Asia and in the Europe area. And that's very similar to our area as rainfall. It's a very seasonal and not much of it. So the Metacauga falcata was the mother to the creeping rooted alfalfas. And the creeping rooted alfalfas, they were bred and marketed for dry land alfalfas. And that's the reason is because of that root system they have. And so that's why you see some of these varieties like Rambler and Roamer and Rangelander and Hendricks and Spreader and Runner and all those. They have different colors flowers in them and everywhere from white light to lighter purple and blue and lighter blues and whatnot. So that's the reasoning behind that one.
That's probably also why it withstands the trampling action so much better, just a different crown arrangement.
Yeah. But when I seen the greater snowplow on it, you know, all winter long and it still persists or year after year, that sold me on it like in the early 1980s. So on our farm, we went on to establish stands of yellow blossom alfalfa and the metabrome grass and the Sicer milk vetch. And then we started grass finishing cattle back in the 1990s. And we started selecting some varieties. We also selected another taproot type alfalfa. We used it and we started taking seed off of our fields and we took some hay for winter hay and we had our cattle grazing on it. We started selecting and some of those selections went on into some trials in Alberta and Saskatchewan and out eastern part of, I think, Quebec. They did some trials and one of the forage associations, they were looking for extremely winter hardy alfalfa that persisted. And so they came to the Peace Country looking for some and the varieties that were growing up here or that we had growing. And so we put a couple of those our varieties in there and they turned out to be some of the most long-lived and most high-yielding varieties and species they had, the subspecies of falcata and then the sativa. So that was encouraging and exciting. I just can't say enough about that species, yellow blossom alfalfa. So and of course, there's articles about ranches down in the U.S. have been growing it in the early 1900s, and it still persists in some of the rangelands there. The productivity is more than double where that was seeded 100 years ago.
You know, maybe some people, they were skeptical, but open to give it a try, and then were kind of amazed what it did for them.
You know, I think one of my neighbors back in the late 1990s, early 2000s, I think it was in about 1999 or something, he's a cattleman and he had pasture and he made hay. And I had just a seed drill, just a double disc seed drill and no packers or nothing. So I said, take the seed drill and take some of this yellow alfalfa and seed your land down or your pastures and whatnot. So he did that and it took a couple of years to establish because it was in established, you know, grasses and whatnot. But I think 2002, we had extreme drought And he was so happy because that was the species that saved him. And we experienced the same thing. It was just the years of extreme drought. It's there persisting and yielding. So that's an amazing story. And he still, to this day, is so happy with it. I know another client I had down in eastern Alberta, actually, in Virgin on the edge of the Palliser Triangle area. I think he seeded a one quarter of purple and one quarter of yellow seed that I provided to him. And then he's since gone, and his son has taken over. And a few years back, his son, he phoned and he wanted more of that, the yellow blossom. He said the purple alfalfa field had been getting less and less and less, pretty, where it's very non-productive. And the yellow one, he says, it kept getting better and better. So he wanted to seed the rest of his farm into that. I've had some clients in interior BC. One of them has an airstrip on one of his rangelands, and he seeded the airstrip down, which was gravel airstrip. He seeded that down. And that was 30 some years ago, and it still persists. He's amazed how it grows on his airstrip. I've had some other clients in the interior BC there that had established stands of that in some of the years where they had the fires in southern BC. They brought some of the cattle up to his rangeland there, and he said just the carrying capacity on that yellow alfalfa was phenomenal. And then hay production. Two years ago, we had a drought scenario, and we had one field of yellow alfalfa, and the rest of them were purple flowered fields. And I think we had, I don't know, like 4 or 5 times as much production on that just one little field of yellow blossom alfalfa than the other one. So it was phenomenal. The fellow that was haying it, he was so surprised that he got so many bales off that field. So just stories like that. And then some of them have had it for 30 years, and they're just still quite happy and seeding down more of it. So
that's pretty amazing. Now, if somebody's listening to this and they're intrigued and they're thinking, gee, where do I get myself some of this yellow blossom alfalfa? You obviously have some on hand and deal with some. Would you just mind explaining all the different varieties that you carry?
Well, I carry about 4 or 5 different varieties. It depends on what people are doing. I've got one variety for if people want to grow green, like a plow down or have it in for a short time. I do kind of a blend of some things for and or for hay production. And then if they're short-term rotation, I have a taproot variety, and that's extremely long-lived and highly productive. And then if they're, doing a longer-term hay production, then I recommend a mix with some of that taproot one and a creeping-rooted one and a yellow blossom one. And then it's going to persist for many years. But if they're going to go for if pasturing comes up or I ask them about pasturing, then I always recommend the yellow blossom alfalfa along with some Metabrome grass and Sicer milk vetch. That's a long-lived pasture because those species are all very long-lived. So, and high yielding. Metabrome grass is a great complementary species with the yellow blossom alfalfa, and Sicer milk vetch is as well. The Metabrome grass is a bunch grass, and its growth pattern, it starts out one of the first grasses that starts growing in the spring, and its growth curve goes straight through the summer and right into the fall, right to the end of the fall. Whereas a lot of the other grass species, they start out a little bit later and then they peak in the 1st of July, and then they just drop off production. Orchard grass is another one, but orchard grass is not as long-lived and winter hardy, so I always, in our area, I always recommend the Metabrome grass. It's a bunch grass. It's similar to orchard grass in that respect, and it can stand grazing. We've grazed it in the wintertime. It carries its feed value, like the Metabrome grass carries its feed value very well through the winter and into the spring. So we've grazed it late in the winter and then again early in the spring, and the yellow blossom alfalfa stands up to it and holds up to it. And of course, the nitrogen fixing capability of the yellow blossom and the Sicer milk vetch is tremendous nitrogen producer, so provides plenty of nitrogen for the Metabrome grass crops. And that's how to have a long-term pasture. So to recap the species or the varieties is a is a taproot variety for going down, tapping deep into the ground, maybe tapping into some subsoil moisture, a creeping rooted variety that's a surface moisture feeder, and they're both, they can regrow, and then for if you want hay, and then a purple flowered blossom one, and then I sometimes recommend a mix, a blend of those three, and I like to put in lots of species and or varieties in a blend for hay production and or pasture too, but the main ones is the ones I mentioned earlier.
Is your yellow blossom, is that still Anik, or is that you've kind of developed it further and now it's an offshoot of that?
Yeah, some of that I selected. I got some seed stocks from the research people back in the 70s and the 80s. And so we started growing some of it and selecting and just picking out the better ones and then reproducing it and selecting and establishing plots and whatnot. And then we just, you know, found some of the hardier ones, I guess. And we've been doing it for 40-some years. And of course, another key component of what we've been doing is the leafcutter bees for pollinating. So we've been doing the leafcutter bees for 40-some years, and we use them for the pollinators of the alfalfa. And that's where our seed stocks originated from, I guess. And we do also have, we've also harvested fields that were established with Anik over the years too, but they've been in trials and they've been a little more persistent and more production oriented. So, you know, that selection helps over the years. So that's the ones we predominantly carry. They're breeding other yellow blossom varieties too, but they're not the original falcatas, but down in the U.S., they brought out some variety here just three or four years ago. And then there's some other varieties that they've crossed, and they're predominantly yellow blossoms too. But I'm not sure if they're the original genetics and whatnot. So I was interested in the original genetics that had that long-lived winter hardiness characteristics to them. So that's what we've been kind of always striving for.
What is the best way for somebody to reach out to you?
Well, usually I put some ads out on, and we do a lot of door-to-door sales and talking to a lot of farmers and ranchers. You know, we don't put too much energy and effort in advertising, but there's a lot of word of mouth. Some of the people that have grown it, they talk to their neighbors, and we do a lot of traveling around talking to farmers and ranchers. That's where we spend some time in the part of the winter, late winter, early spring. We spend a lot of time on the road talking to farmers and ranchers. And a few years ago, I started a consulting business for regenerative agriculture. I call it Regen Eco Ag. I do a consulting for mineral balancing soils, establishing long-term perennials and grazing management, et cetera. I think, you know, if they hear about it, they usually find me and give me a call and take it from there, I guess. People that are, you know, establishing forages and stuff. And that's when I like to talk to them about their soils too, because, you know, with a mineral balancing soil, it's very important to get, you know, especially for legumes and alfalfa and whatnot. So it's mostly word of mouth and us traveling. We travel around lots and try to figure out what they need, and we advise them what we could offer them to help them, whatever they're doing. If they're hay producers or cattle producers, and if they're doing a lot of pasture management, for example. And we spend quite a bit of time in interior BC and in the Peace Country, and we keep busy enough doing that.
And on top of it, you're also an organic producer, right? We didn't even touch on that.
Yeah, I guess in 1988, we went from, I think I farmed for 10 years, we were using with fertilizers and herbicides. And then in 1988, we started basically all over again and just got out of that and started studying more of an ecological approach. And we took a course in holistic management. Resource management is called back then, holistic management. That was a decision-making model, and that led us into studying more regenerative agriculture principles, and we started studying, going down to the Acres USA down in the States, and they'd have a conference, and they had a magazine, and then that's where I learned of, you know, William Albrecht's work. He's a soil microbiologist, and he was University of Missouri, and his job was to identify nitrogen-fixing bacteria. And when he identified rhizobia bacteria, and then when he went to replicate his work on different sites, he wasn't having very much success. So he started looking at the chemistry of the soil,
and he stumbled onto the greatest thing when he found the chemistry in the soil. When he adjusted the chemistry in the soil, his microbiology started to work. So I've been studying with one of his students, Neil Kinsey, since the 2000s, I think. And I went over to New Zealand and studied with another fellow over there that's very successful in pasture management and soil mineral balancing soils. And it's very, really exciting. So we've been working with that for quite a few years now, and we're getting more and more field data on the mineral balancing, and we're actually moving a lot of soils that are out of balance. And when I say balance, we're looking at the base elements of calcium, magnesium, potassium, and sodium to get those in certain percentages. For instance, calcium has to be ideally at 68% on the soil plates, and magnesium has to be 12%, and potassium 3%, and sodium 2%. That leaves about 12% hydrogen on your soil plate. Then it creates a harmonious effect. The microbes just take off, and minerals start to be released. It's exciting to see that. And that's what it's all about, is microbiology in your soil. And that's what William Ulbricht stumbled onto after the Second World War, and his work went into the 50s and 60s and 70s. So we've been doing that, and we've been learning lots about that. Of course, that flows very well with establishing long-term perennials and pastures, and that's very beneficial. And of course, we've been farming with regenerative principles and organic principles, I guess, if you want to call them, back since the late 1980s.
And it takes healthy soils to grow healthy crops. So I thank you so much for your time today in explaining to us the amazing properties of the Medicago falcata, the yellow blossom alfalfa, and how it's really an underrated alfalfa variety and could do so well in our Peace region. I think one of the number one properties that producers are looking for when I talk to them is stand longevity in their pastures. So
it's been great, and we just want to try to get that information to as many people as we can and pass that knowledge down. I really enjoy young clients that are just starting up, so I kind of try to help them. I always think back when I started up, I didn't have too much knowledge, so it's really a pleasure to work with young farmers and help them get off to a good start, because it's so easy to not to get off to a good start, and it's lots of times fields or their soil is kind of the hand that they got dealt, whether they inherited it or they bought it or rented it or whatever, however they got that land, but that's what they have to work with. And so I try to help improve that, make a longer term stability in your land and you're building your soil and you've got long-term perennials, for instance. And so with all that comes stability and profitability.
Mistakes can be so expensive, especially nowadays when input costs are so high. It's certainly valuable if you have somebody who can help you along those steps.
I learned some of the things the hard way, so I know it's nice to have some knowledge, and I've always focused on trying to go out and find the knowledge for what we're doing here on our farm, and it's been quite rewarding. I just look forward to sharing some of that, and so yeah, anybody's more than welcome to give me a call or get in touch with me and see where they're at with their plans and see how we can help them out.
Well, again, thank you so much for your time, Peter, and for sharing your knowledge today. And hopefully we can help share the knowledge a little bit by sharing this podcast.
Thank you very much for getting in touch with me, and you keep up your good work.
Welcome back. As Peter indicated, he is more than happy to talk to anyone interested in learning more about yellow blossom alfalfa and how to choose a forage blend that will support your land and production goals. Next up is a chat with another seed grower as we make a jump from forage seed to grain seed production. Dave Wuttridge grows pedigree barley, oats, and peas, and has a wealth of experience in taking many seeds, often from experimental founder plots, all the way to commercialization. Be sure to check out the next episode to learn more about the process of developing new annual crop seed varieties. If you found value in this or other episodes of our Knowledge for Resilience series, please share with your friends, family, and colleagues. You can find us on various podcast platforms, including Podbean, Spotify, iHeartRadio, Google Podcasts, and of course, the three partner association websites. Wherever you tune in from, make sure you like, subscribe, or follow us so you never miss another episode. Funding for this project was provided by the BC Hydro Peace Agricultural Compensation Fund. Thank you so much for making this project possible and supporting local agriculture in the Peace and beyond. For feedback or suggestions on other great Peace Region-related agricultural topics, email us at coordinator@peaceforge.bc.ca. Until next time, stay informed, stay resilient.